Welcome to Unintended Consequences from Intent Clinical, where we are discussing the topics that most people don't want to talk about in public, let alone at a holiday meal. Today's guest is Dr. Devika Bhushan, the Chief Medical Officer at Daybreak Health and the adjunct faculty member at Stanford University, and previously was the California Acting Surgeon General and the office's inaugural Chief Health Officer. She has been very open about not just policy and seeking to make sure that people receive care in ways that are healthy for communities and for individuals, but she's also been very open about her own struggles with bipolar disorder. Today, we're going to talk about that feature of her life and how it manifested over a period of time and what she has even found helpful. So thank you, Devika, for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Diana. Thanks for having me.
Great. Let's start. Unlike a lot of things in the things we talk about that don't seem to have a start or a beginning of a story, you do have a beginning of a story. And I would love for our listeners to really hear that story because it is very powerful.
Sure. You know, a lot of people can pinpoint a period in their lives or a specific time when something didn't quite feel right. And for me, that time really happened when I was in medical school. So it was the end of my first year, the summer, really between the first and the second years of medical school. I was in the middle of the mountains in a country I'd never been to before, setting up a program from the ground up. And I was there alone. I was cut off from all of my systems of support. I was speaking and conducting myself in my third language, Spanish. And I was just very alone and bereft in many different ways and dealing with a lot of difficult things on the ground.
How old were you? Just out of curiosity.
I think I was 23.
So you're 23, you're in a foreign country. It's not your primary language or your second language. It's your third language.
Right.
And the customs and culture are very different, and you're fairly isolated and lonely. Am I painting that picture?
Exactly. And I'm setting up a program that...
At 23,
that really helps to bring a new kind of care to the people who are living in that community. And things aren't quite working right. And I start feeling very out of sorts. I start not being able to sleep. I start feeling exhausted, but up entire nights, just looking at the ceiling, waiting for the sun to rise, not really sure what is going to happen the next day, but knowing that it's going to be that leaden feeling of just sheer exhaustion and not being able to form the right words and say the right thing, and chalking all of that really up to where I was and hoping that once I come back home, everything goes back to what I know to be normal. And unfortunately, in the summer, I go to the Philippines, which is where my parents were based at the time that I come back to Boston, which is where my partner was, where school was, where I was living. And neither one of those places of home did what I was hoping. And I was just sort of faking it, going through the motions. And when I was back in Boston, it became very clear that something had really shifted. I remember going to school and not being excited and feeling the full range of emotions I would normally feel on seeing my friends again. People would ask me how my summer was, how I was doing, what I was looking forward to, and it would be such a struggle to come up with the right thing to say to look and feel normal.
Did you mask?
I did. It took all of my energy just to seem normal.
Normal.
But really what I was feeling inside was just vacant. Absence of emotion, absence of cognitive and intellectual curiosity. Just couldn't make sense of what was happening in school for the first time. I would read passages and not make any sense of it. And I'd read it again, and it would be like I'd never even read it before.
Scary.
Very scary, because I'd always relied on my brain to work for me and with me. And it was the first time in my life that I was experiencing being outside of it and without it. And after about a week or two of feeling like this, I actually, with my mom, who is a public health specialist, she basically was like, this feels to me like you could be depressed. And I think that you should go and talk to somebody. And it was funny because we had studied depression in school. And I thought that you had to feel sad or blue for this to be depression. And truly, I felt nothing. I felt the absence of all emotion. So it kind of took me by surprise, but it was very validating when I finally received that diagnosis of depression from a professional. And essentially what transpired from there was I was started on an antidepressant, an SSRI, and people who live with bipolar disorder or know anything about the bipolar spectrum will know that if you have bipolar depression, an SSRI will often make your symptoms worse. They might trigger a hypomanic or a manic episode. They might put a mixed qualifier onto the depression, meaning you have both depression and some kind of an up symptom like a hypomania at the same time. And that's really what happened to me. So over the next 2.5 or so years, I was on different combinations of medications and always with an activating SSRI backbone, which really layered that irritability, the hypomanic energy on top of the depression. And because for me personally, I'd never been hypomanic, I didn't have a history of bipolarity either in my family or personally, it wasn't clear at all to my treatment team that what I was experiencing was actually on the bipolar spectrum. And in fact, it seemed like, okay, well, this is just anxiety and depression rather than hypomania and depression showing up.
Yeah. So your experience highlights what many people describe as their experience in getting a correct diagnosis, right? This is not an uncommon 2.5 years that people go through to receive one. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right. And actually, on average, for people who live with bipolar 2 disorder, which is a little more difficult to diagnose because it can be a little more subtle to manifest hypomania, which is the hallmark of bipolar 2, as opposed to mania, which is the hallmark of bipolar 1 disorder. So people who live with bipolar 2 on average take about 11 years between the first time they have a symptom of any kind and the right diagnosis and treatments. So for me, I was very lucky. 2.5 to 3 years is on the lowest end of that range. And in many ways, I was an insider, right? Because I was training to be a doctor myself, and I was within the system that had a lot of good healthcare access. And even despite all of that, it took as long as it did. And the thing that saved me, honestly, Diana, was the fact that 2.5, 3 years into this journey, when I was starting to lose hope that I would ever find my brain ever again, that I could actually be successful in my career, that I could hack it in medical school, something happened, which was that I was on 3 different medications that were activating. And that combination for me resulted in a manic episode.
Not a hypomanic episode.
Not a hypomanic episode, a manic episode. It was very clear what was happening. And unlike when I was first depressed, I recognized what was going on for myself. And I felt validated and vindicated that there is a name to what I've been experiencing. And there is a whole set of treatments that we can think about now, the mood stabilizers. Obviously, medications are one piece of what keeps somebody well, but it just felt exhilarating, to be honest, to finally have an answer. So that manic episode truly saved me.
How low did you go before that manic episode? They're adding medications or they're adding and taking away medications. Did you get deep, deep depression during that period?
Yeah. And I would say, you know, overall, looking back at all of the kinds of symptoms that I've had in my life, about 70 to 80% of my symptoms have been in the depressive part of the spectrum. And then the rest, I would say, have been in the sort of hypomanic irritability end of the spectrum. And I did have a very deep depression, especially right after my manic episode, because as people know, the pendulum that swings up also then swings down with almost as much force, if not as much force. And I was suicidal, and it took a lot to get me out of that. But You know, it took probably 6 to 8 months to really stabilize on a course of mood stabilizers, changing my diet, replacing simple carbs with protein and healthy fats, whole foods, things like that. I did a number of things altogether, including making sure that I was getting sunlight in the beginnings of my days and these kinds of things. I was in therapy. It took a lot, but basically, I finally felt back to myself. And this was probably 4 years after my first episode. Yeah.
And what I'm hearing, which is a relief to me, is that you're not saying there's a single solution. It was a combination of things that it sounds like you embarked upon at the same time. Not only did you have the relief of a validating diagnosis, now we can start with an adequate treatment. And it sounds like once you got on the adequate treatment, you were starting to climb out of that deep. Is that right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
But it sounds low. During that low, I ask guests this because it's interesting to me. What did you turn to for support and care? What did you turn to?
It's such a hard thing, as anyone who's experienced this themselves, seen a loved one go through it, to lose who you are when you're going through an episode of a mental illness. And the harder part about it is you have no idea when it will end, and you don't have control over it. And so a lot of it is riding the wave, knowing that at some point you hope for hopefully a decisive and a quick end to the episode, but just to know that while you're in it, and I had 2 subsequent episodes too, so this is something that I've had some practice with. When you're in it, your thoughts are like molasses.
Mm-hmm.
You don't remember the things that you've just been told. You can't read. You can't do the things that really generally you do to relax, to unwind. You can't connect with people. You can't go to parties. You feel completely out of sorts.
More alien in that environment than being alone.
Absolutely. And so it's a lot of time with yourself and a version of yourself that honestly is really hard to spend time with because you're really self-blamey and
loathing. Yes.
You don't like the way your thoughts are spinning, and you don't like the way your brain is suddenly not working, and you don't like yourself. And honestly, it was the supportive family. So my husband and my mom who helped me walk through that and get to the other side of the episodes that I had when I was in those lows. It is so hard to retain a semblance of hope that things will get better, that this is actually not the new you. You're not stuck like this forever, because one day leads to the next. And it really does start feeling like this is it. This is the new normal.
I get that. I'm hearkening a thought, which is my dad also had bipolar too. He was a guest on one of our first episodes of our earlier iteration of this podcast. He had been dean of Yale Medical School. He had been a science officer for a drug company and did not get medication until he was 65. And some of that was stigma. What prevented him was the stigma surrounding the diagnosis. Now, he was significantly older. He was almost 90 when he died. But I wonder, did stigma play any role for you in your journey?
A huge role, yes. And I think that stigma always starts within the self. I mean, well, it originates in stereotypes and assumptions and stories that we as a society tell about people who are ill with different kinds of disorders and illnesses. And bipolar disorder is especially, as you know, shrouded in stereotypes that are really rooted in people who are at their most unwell phases of the illness. Because so many of us, when we're doing fine with it, when we recovered, when we figured out how to stay well with it, we hide our stories. We hide those parts of ourselves that we think could mean we won't get that next promotion, or we won't be thought of in a certain favorable light by colleagues, by friends, by family members. And so many people stay silent about all of the ways in which having an illness like bipolarity has actually enriched you or been a part of your story and your success journey. But in any case, because of the stereotypes and the stigma, we internalize these beliefs about who it is that has bipolar disorder and who we are as a consequence of being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And there's always a disconnect at the beginning between who you think of yourself as and these very culturally laden notions of who has bipolar disorder. And I had that for myself, and I didn't see myself as somebody who fit that cultural norm of who we think of as having bipolar disorder. And I went to Harvard Medical School, which is where I was diagnosed. And there, especially, there was a deep sense of othering of people who had mental illnesses in general and people in my class as well as in the community. I went to Harvard University Health Services for my healthcare, and I learned from my care providers that not only did a large majority of people who went to grad school and professional school and undergrad there end up with different mental illnesses, but there was a preponderance of bipolarity actually within Harvard Medical School. And there's this idea in medicine at large that people with mental health conditions aren't necessarily to be trusted with patient care. And this is embedded in things like the licensing and credentialing forms that we have to fill out that ask us,
have you ever been diagnosed with a mental health concern, right? It's very broad too.
Very broad. And it requires us to fill out pages and pages and pages of information, including going back to when I applied for the California medical license, I had to submit letters from every single treating provider I'd ever had, which had been probably a decade or so of treatment across many different states and even countries.
Is that infuriating to you?
Think about the fact that untreated diabetes, untreated arthritis, any kind of inflammatory pain dysregulation type of a syndrome, all of them affect your ability to think and judge and feel. But we don't hold people who suffer from so-called physical health conditions to that same degree of suspicion and proving your mettle before you can start to be trusted. And actually, I heard a ton of really unfounded and unfair judgment towards patients who had different kinds of mental illnesses from my colleagues. I remember coming in the morning and taking sign out from people who had been on the admitting overnight team. And there was a young woman who was admitted, I think, for an asthma exacerbation. She had bipolar disorder, and she had had an altercation with her roommate. And the sign out was, well, she says it wasn't her fault, but who really knows, because she has bipolar disorder, so she's probably lying. And these kinds of statements are very common, actually, within medicine. And it makes you understand that people assume this is a them over there problem, and we within the ranks of medicine can't be within the ranks of the people who also suffer from conditions like bipolar disorder. But it also goes to this one of the stereotypes around bipolarity and other stigmatized illnesses is that people are willfully misleading you and can't be trusted and are liars and cheaters and violent and all of these things.
All of these things.
So those stigmas went really deep. And for all of those reasons, I actually stayed pretty closeted about having bipolar disorder when I was in my training in the early parts of my career. And it wasn't until I was working in public health, working on the ACEs Aware initiative in California at the Office of the California Surgeon General, and starting to step into the leadership position as acting Surgeon General, that I started feeling like it was really important to be the same person I was internally and with my inner circles as I wanted to be externally.
So brave. I want you to know, I think it is so brave to be that honest, frankly, about not just what you do, but who you are doing that. And it is a brave act. Most of us have a personal self and a professional self. And it isn't that you don't still have both of those things, but there is a better blend of that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I felt really strongly that I had been inspired by people sharing their journeys. For example, I have a friend, dear friend, Dr. Justin Bullock, who is also a physician who lives with bipolar 2 disorder. And he had been public with his journey when he was still in training. He wrote about it as an intern.
Oh, how brave. Yeah.
And at the time, he lived in the Bay Area as well. And now he's in Seattle. But looking to people like him convinced me that I wanted to be part of the wave of destigmatizing, of telling our full truths, of really holding space for all of the nuance and all of the complexity. And we all know this, that stereotypes really thrive in the face of misinformation,
darkness, absence
of information, ignorance, right? And they really shatter when we bring three-dimensional stories of human complexity that don't sit squarely within the confines of a two-dimensional stereotype. Those are the things, telling our stories to the extent that we have the privilege and the safety to do so, those are the things that really help explode stereotypes. Or what else could have been more important?
Your story and that statement really does resonate with my dad's mission after he got on treatment. And he didn't get treatment until he tried to die by suicide. And he got treatment and he wrote an article and New York Times op-ed piece. And he became very public about how stigma delayed treatment for him and how, as medical profession, we need to be more open-minded about that they aren't in the other. So love that.
100%. I'm so glad your dad was able to get to that place for himself.
Me too.
And also, I'm sure that was foundational in your relationship as well.
Oh, well, of course. Of course. So we've touched on stigma. We've touched on sort of the descent into a diagnosis. What brought you or brings you that kind of light and joy that is very obvious from both your voice and your face?
So much brings me light and joy. I can tell you about sort of the practices that I use to stay well. And then I can tell you about the things that really help me to bridge beyond wellness into actual thriving, right? So the things that I use as tools in that well-being toolkit are therapy. I've been in therapy on and off pretty consistently, I would say, since 2008. So it's been since really the beginning of my journey. And I've been on a medication or two, sometimes three, depending on what was going on, ever since the beginning of that journey as well. For bipolarity in particular, people are really, really sensitive to circadian rhythm shifts. And by that same token, it can be super grounding for all of us who suffer from mental health conditions of all kinds, but specifically mood disorders, for us to be grounded in the day and night cues that we have outside. So namely, spending enough time outside in the sunshine, especially in the beginning half of your day, really sets you up.
Is that right? It matters when, huh?
Yeah, it matters when. It matters when, because seeing the sun in the beginning of the day helps motivate and regulate all of your diurnal rhythms, right? From your cortisol regulation to your energy levels, your mood, your cognition, all of the things that are gated in the circadian way. And then it helps you also switch off and go to bed sooner and sleep better if you have a sense of true day and night synced, which is essentially just spending time outside. And at nighttime, what I do on the other end of that is I make sure I have a very consistent bedtime. So I usually go to bed shortly after my toddler does. So around 9:30, somewhere in that range. And if I am doing something like watching TV at night, I wear my blue light blockers. So these are amber lenses, which decrease the amount of blue light that is actually hitting your retina. And blue light, as people might know, is the wavelength of light that signals to your brain that it's actually daytime.
Time to wake up. Yeah.
It shuts off the production of melatonin, which is your sleep regulating hormone. it basically makes you feel wide awake when you should be falling asleep at night, right? And this is because we have artificial lights all around us, which have blue wavelengths of light. The screens that we use certainly give us a strong dose of it too. So I find that these blue light blockers really help with that. They've been marketed as decreasing your eye strain and so forth when you're using computers, which they actually haven't been proven to do. But the randomized studies that have looked at sleep and manic symptoms and so forth have borne out some results. So I use them for that purpose. And then I exercise several times a week. I'm a big walker. I like to spend some time in nature, listen to the birds. It's both a mindfulness activity for me and an exercise and a place to sort of process things that might be going on for me. So it does multiple things. I've started doing some strength training as well. Now I'm almost 40. So the older we get, the better it is for us to make sure we're protecting our bones and our joints and our muscles and setting ourselves up for longevity. So that's become an important piece of my movement regimen. And I spend a lot of time with loved ones. So I wake up every morning and goof off
you
with
my toddler. Yeah.
Yep. He wakes me up and we have dance parties. And,
I love that.
It's just a barrel of fun anytime I'm around my little guy. And my husband and I, we've been together now 2 decades. So we've literally been through thick and thin and could not ask for a better partner in life. He just gets me, sees me, supports me, helps me be my best self. I have so much fun with him. So he's honestly, I am so lucky that I have him in my life. And so he definitely helps keep me grounded. And then I think purpose and meaning and finding the things that give you a sense that you are doing something that matters, that makes a difference for people. And so that's my work and a lot of the professional and personal connections related to that work. And the work that I do now is a few different things. Essentially, I advise startups and nonprofits around themes of resilience and health equity. I also serve, as you mentioned, on Stanford's faculty, as well as chief medical officer at a mental health startup that really helps bring mental health support to families and youth in need. And we do that in a way that makes it free for the kiddos and the families. And so I'm really privileged to be at Daybreak, to be doing that work every day. And I'm also very invested in changing the cultural levers that we have as far as how we think about gender and race and representations of mental illness in movies and TV shows. And so I can't speak very publicly yet about this, but I'm working on a new project, which is a TV series, which is aiming to do just this.
Well, we will update the notes on our website when that happens. So please let us know when it is no longer a secret.
Absolutely. Love to.
What a great place to wrap it up. It's so forward-thinking and future and hopeful. I love that. So for our listeners today, if you enjoyed our conversation, and I can't imagine you didn't, frankly, please like us on your platform of choice. I have one final question before we leave. If you were going to laminate something and carry it in your pocket, a statement of some kind to tell yourself during all kinds of moments, what would it be?
I love this quote by Rumi, and Rumi is my son's namesake. We are big fans of the name and the person and his poetry. And he said, "The wound is the place where the light enters." And this is not meant to be a place of toxic positivity, but rather to understand that it is the things that break us and the ways in which we break and then put ourselves back together again, that are the sources of our deepest vulnerabilities and biggest strengths. It's that reshaped bowl or vessel that is not only more beautiful and stronger than what came before, but it is the most unique version of who we could have been. And so it's this idea that it's the struggles that end up shaping the most unique assets that we can give to others. And so for me, that's been a deep sense of empathy and ability to walk alongside
compassion.
Somebody else who whether it's a patient, a family member, a colleague who's going through something really, really difficult. It's my own experiences with that that has given me the ability to walk alongside somebody else in that moment. For other people, you know, it's things like creativity. It's things like knowing what your own self-care boundaries need to be so that you can be resilient through many different other challenges in your life. So I would say, even when the struggles are so tough in the moment, just know that walking through them will lead you to a place and a person who is better for it and who is stronger for it.
Thank you. Thank you for today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate everything that you all are doing with this podcast and community.
When you feel called out, don't let the words let you drown. Take all of the sound and throw it to the wind. All of it is noise, trying to throw you off your track. Don't let it win, don't let it turn back. Ooh, I know you think it's all figured out.
This podcast was produced by Amaze Media Labs.